So thanks, everybody. What I want to do is present some work that's in progress. And I don't know where to look now. I'll look at my real audience and forget that the remote audience is there. So what I'm doing is going to present some work in progress, and I'm looking for some feedback on part of it. So this is kind of a funny stage of work in progress because I have been working on this for a little while now, so I've written a bunch on it, but the goal of this talk is really to try to abstract from the details as much as possible to pull a thread out of what I want to present and make sure that the main strongest conclusions I want to draw are not being lost in the thicket of details. So I'm going to start by providing a sort of historical backdrop to what I want to say about my contemporary case. So my contemporary case is going to be quantum field theory and statistical mechanics, and I'm going to focus on the use of renormalization group methods in the two theories. In order to set up what I want to say, I'm going to talk for a few minutes about a much earlier example of what I take to be a similar kind of phenomena. So the earlier case study I'm going to talk about is Maxwell's development of electromagnetism. I take it that this is a similar case study to the one I'm going to be talking about because it possesses the two features I'm going to be focusing on. So first of all, this was a case in the history of physics in which Maxwell's route to electromagnetism was simultaneously guided by analogies between theories of heat and theories of incompressible fluids, which he then exploited to formulate his equations for electromagnetism. And of course, from a present-day perspective, we look at that development as being an example of the application of the same piece of mathematics, a potential theory, in all three fields. So I think that something similar is happening in my contemporary case study. I also think it's useful to keep in, so I don't take it that these are contradictory analyses of what's going on in any way. I think in the Maxwell case it's fairly clear that you can talk about this development as both being an example of the application of one piece of mathematics in a bunch of different domains, as well as a case in which you're drawing analogies between the different domains. So, sorry at Western if this is losing you, but what I'm thinking about applicability of math, I'm thinking about having some sort of uninterpreted formalism, and then you give it, statistical mechanical interpretation, or a quantum field theory, particle physics interpretation. Whereas when I'm thinking about analogical reasoning, what you're most focused on is mappings between quantities in the two theories, right? So I take it these are complementary perspectives on the same phenomena, but I think it's useful to think about them think about them together, and you'll see why as I go through the case study. All right, so the conclusion I'm going to draw is that I think what's going on in the statistical mechanics and quantum field theory case is going to be familiar to us from our understanding of what's happening in the Maxwell case. In particular, I think that it's going to be...
Is there a way for us to hear, see her and the slide at the same time?
No, they didn't. We were going to try to set it up so we were going to have the PowerPoint here. And then her on the, and they evidently didn't do that.
Okay.
And what they're going to do is keep switching back and forth.
All right.
Okay. So in particular, I think the cautionary moral I want to draw is that while there are analogies between system mechanics and quantum field theory, we have to be careful not to assume, because there are analogies, that there are substantial physical similarities between the two theories. So really the point I want to get to is asking a bunch of questions to you about what I take to be a sort of mismatch between my conclusion of this sort and the way that physicists actually go about doing quantum field theory and statistical mechanics right now, and the way the practice works. I think that's kind of interesting, and I want to kind of get people's sense about that. So, there's a lot to say here, but I'm not going to say it all. So what I have here is a picture of one of Maxwell's famous ether models, where he has cells of fluid and he has idle wheels between the cells. This is one of the models, one of many models he used involving fluids, in order to develop his equations for electromagnetism, and in order to unify optics with electromagnetism. So this was a program in physics that didn't begin with Maxwell. Calvin William Thompson was the first, I think, or one of the first to get on to the fact that you could use theories of heat conduction, for example, to understand electrostatics and charge distributions, and also that you could use incompressible fluids as a model. So Maxwell had many models of this sort, and some of the models he represented the lines of force with as tubes of incompressible fluid, and he was able to use these models as a guide for him to formulate his equations for electromagnetism. So first of all, I think one of the useful things in thinking about this case, which obviously I've given a too quick sketch of, is, of course, hindsight is 20/20, right? So we know what to think in this case. In Maxwell's day, it was a live option that some sort of ether model was a realistic model, was a possible model for electromagnetism. So nowadays, with the advantage of hindsight, we know that that would have been the wrong interpretation of what was going on in this case. The other thing I really like about this case study is that Maxwell himself, as well as the others involved in this program, were very self-conscious about the use to which they were putting their models. Okay, and so I'm mixing up quotes about different models, but I just want to give you a flavor without going through all of the interesting details. Okay, so the first quote is about the model I had on the previous slide. He says, "I do not bring it forward as a mode of connection existing in nature, or even as that which I'm willing assent to as an electrical hypothesis." Okay, so he recognizes that he doesn't think that this model is actually a realistic model for electromagnetism. One of the earlier models, he says something which is going to resonate with comments that much later physicists make about quantum field theory and system mechanics. He says, "The substance here treated of is not even a hypothetical fluid which is introduced to explain actual phenomena. It is merely a collection of imaginary properties which may be employed for establishing certain theorems in pure mathematics in a way more intelligible to many minds and more applicable to physical problems than that in which algebraic symbols alone are used." Okay, so what's at the core of what's going on, at least from the present perspective, is that you can apply a mathematical theory of potentials. You can apply the same equations, whether you're talking about heat conduction or incompressible fluids or electromagnetism. Okay, so at an abstract level, you're applying the same piece of uninterpreted mathematical formalism as Maxwell puts it. You're employing algebraic symbols, but in order to formulate the theory, Maxwell thinks he wanted more, he needed more than just having the abstract mathematics. He found it intuitive and helpful to his thinking about what was going on to be able to think about a concrete model, right? To be able to think about the incompressible fluids. Also interesting in this respect is that while Calvin spent a bunch of time thinking about heat conduction as his analog model. Maxwell says, by the time he's writing a little bit later, the caloric theory of heat, physicists have recognized, is not the right way to go. So he makes the conscious decision not to use heat as a model, because you can't think it's not possible to think of heat as being a fluid anymore, right? So there is something very intuitive about thinking about how fluids work, which was helping Maxwell, giving him some intuitions, which then applied to the electromagnetism case, even though physically what was going on was quite different in the two cases. Okay, so this case study is sort of set up. If you fast forward many years, if you fast forward over 100 years, the link to the quantum field theory case and statistical mechanics case is that, as is well recognized, right, this is another case in which analogies between the domain of statistical mechanics and the domain of quantum field theory drove theoretical developments in both fields. I'm going to be focusing here on a particular stage of the development. So I'm not a physicist. One of the ways I try to get a handle on what's going on in physics is by trying to understand the historical development of the field. So this is now history before I was born, so I count it as history. So I'm going to be focusing on what the original application of renormalization group methods in quantum field theory looks like. So I'm focusing on one of the seminal papers by Wilson and co-author Kogut from 1974. So one thing to say about this is, before I get into the details, is to fix my terminology. So I've been using the term quantum field theory here to apply to quantum field theory as it's applied in particle physics. This gets tricky because, and actually we're going to get into this later in the talk, but the use of the terminology gets tricky because you have people writing textbooks such as quantum field theory and condensed matter physics, right? So, and in fact, this is part of what I'm talking about here. Is the reason for that is because the same mathematical formalism can be applied in the same cases, right? In both cases, right? So this gets parsed as quantum field theory for condensed matter physics. But I just want to flag that when I'm using quantum field theory here, I'm talking about quantum field theory in particle physics. All right, so in this paper, Wilson and Kogut put forward a method which they repeatedly describe as a method for constructing or deriving quantum field theory from statistical mechanics. Okay, so more particularly, the end goal of the construction is a continuum quantum field theory, which is being constructed from statistical mechanics on a lattice. Okay, so already the use of the term construction, right, and in putting that forward as the goal of the project, you can see that what's being put front and center here is the analogical relationship between statistical mechanics and quantum field theory. Okay, so what's really important here is that you can map quantities in statistical mechanics to quantities in quantum field theory, and then that allows you to go back and forth between statistical mechanics and the quantum field theory, and then you can exploit that relationship in order to get what you want on the quantum field theory side. Okay, so that's what's going on here, putting the analogical relationship front and center. Okay, so I'm gonna sketch the construction. Obviously, there are many more details here. What I'm trying to do is to focus on the details which are going to be relevant for the points I want to make in a few minutes. For the sake of concreteness and simplicity, I'm going to focus on a special case of the construction. Obviously, the construction is much more general than this special case. But for concreteness, focus on the statistical mechanical side of the analogical mapping. the system of an icing model for a ferromagnet. Okay, so you have a bunch of lattice. You have a lattice, and then you have a spin field that you define on the lattice. And the spin field can take the values plus 1 or minus 1. Okay, so the spin field is defined on a spatial lattice. The quantum field theory system I'm going to consider is the simple one of a scalar phi 4 self-interacting field. Okay, so it's simpler because it's a scalar field. The phi 4 part is going to make our life simple because what we're going to have to do, what we want to do when we are when we're trying to formulate the continuum quantum field theory, is we have to renormalize the thing, right? So when we're renormalizing, focusing on this special case means that the only non-trivial renormalization is going to be in the mass. So we can kind of ignore what's going on with the charge, which simplifies the story a little bit. Okay, so the construction of the continuum quantum field theory from the statistical mechanics is a two-step process. The first step is a step which involves making the mapping from the statistical mechanical theory to the quantum field theory. Okay, so it's important that in step one, what we do is we are mapping quantities in the statistical mechanical theory on a lattice to the quantum field theory on a spatial lattice as well. Okay, so step one is just to set up the correspondence, the mappings, and then step two is going to be to exploit the relationship between statistical mechanics and quantum field theory to successfully take the continuum limit and get rid of the lattice in the quantum field theory case. Okay, so the whole point of the construction, this particular construction, is to get what we want on the quantum field theory side. What we want on the quantum field theory side is a continuum theory. So the method for getting that is to first of all impose the lattice, set up the correspondence with statistical mechanics, and then you take the continuum limit to get rid of the lattice, and you use the relationship with statistical mechanics to keep everything nice and finite, essentially. Okay, so the quantities that get identified, that get mapped between the statistical mechanics and the quantum field theory are, on the statistical mechanical side, the correlation function between the values of spin on different lattice sites. Okay, so the N and M here is just are labels for the lattice sites. Zeta is just a scale factor, so you can ignore that. So the left-hand side is the correlation function from statistical mechanics. The right-hand side is the propagator for the lattice quantum field theory. So the lattice is a spatial lattice, and that's the M. And the N is giving us the discrete values of the imaginary time variable. Okay, so what's happening here is, obviously we have a mapping, we have a correspondence. Better than that, we have an equation that takes us from our statistical mechanical quantity to the quantum field theory quantity. What we need to do in order to do that is to Wick rotate the quantum field theory. That means that instead of having the time variable in our propagator, what we have is the minus imaginary time variable. Okay, so that's taking the Euclidean theory, theory on Euclidean space, to the theory on Minkowski space. As an aside, you can think of the propagator in sort of textbook, sort of crude terms, as giving you the amplitude for a free particle to scatter from one lattice point to another lattice point. Okay, I won't comment any more on that. All right, so so the first step is to come up with that that identity. The second step is then to exploit the relationship with statistical mechanics to get the continuum quantum field theory that we are actually looking for in the first place. Okay. So looking at the relationship that we have between the correlation functions and the propagator, if we focus on the long-range behavior of both the correlation function and the propagator, long-distance behavior, then what we're going to get is this relationship here. So on the right-hand side, you have the correlation length in statistical mechanics, which is giving you the range, the distance range over which you have correlations between between your spin values. On the left-hand side, you have the inverse renormalized mass from the quantum field theory, which is also going to come up later as the correlation length in quantum field theory. So essentially, it's playing the same role. It's giving you a measure of the distance range over which you have correlations. So when we renormalize the theory, we want the renormalized mass to stay finite, right? We actually want more than that, right? We want the vacuum expectation values, we want the propagators to stay finite as well, but as a first step in that, we need to make sure that the renormalized mass stays finite. Okay, so the relationship we're getting here between our statistical mechanics and our quantum field theory is that the correlation function has to be divided by lambda. Okay, so here lambda is the momentum, right? So you could do the same thing with lattice spacing if you wanted. Because this is quantum field theory, the momentum cutoff is the more relevant value. So what we want to do is remove the lattice, which means taking the lattice spacing to zero, equivalently taking the momentum to infinity. So you can see if what we need to happen is to have the renormalized mass stay finite, and it's equal to the correlation length divided by the momentum, then if we're going to take the momentum to infinity, we have to take the correlation length to infinity as well. Okay, so what you see there is what's going to be relevant for obtaining the continuum quantum field theory is the critical point of the of the statistical mechanical theory. Okay, so now I'm going to move over to the board. Hopefully, people are following me. Can people at Western see me over here now? Is that a yes?
We can't hear you.
We can't hear you.
Now we are.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
We are now looking at the board.
Okay, all right, so what we want to do now is to take the limit, right? We're interested in the limit in which the momentum goes to infinity, right? So we're trying to remove the lattice. So the strategy for doing that is to take several limits simultaneously. All right, so what we're doing over here, the yellow, is we're taking a limit of Bayer theories, right, with Bayer mass, this is the Bayer mass, mu zero. And we're taking the limit in such a way that we end up on the critical surface for the statistical mechanical theory, right? That's what we got from our previous equation, that if we're going to be able to keep the renormalized mass finite, then this is what we have to succeed in doing, is to get to the critical surface, right? So the red star, of course, is the goal of the whole process, which is we want to be able to derive this effective theory, which is going to be renormalized, it's going to be a continuum theory, and it's going to have the right finite value for the renormalized mass. So how we do that is we iteratively take limits. So we're going to be iteratively taking the yellow limit, right, which is taking the momentum to infinity, removing the lattice. At the same time, we're going to be applying the renormalization group transformation to each of these theories, which we're obtaining by getting closer and closer to the lambda equals infinity theory that we're actually looking for. So what we're going to do is we're going to get to this point by going down here and keeping following these trajectories. Then we can take the green limit to figure out what this theory is, right? So the renormalization group transformation is going to reparameterize the theory, which is why we get mu r, which is different from mu naught, But it's, and it's going to do it, it's going to reparameterize the theory in such a way that if what we're focused on is the renormalized effective theory we get at the end of the day, then at relatively low energy scales that we're concerned about once we get up here, then you're going to have a physically equivalent theory to what you started out with down here. Of course, the advantage of the theory you get up at the top, the effective theory, is that it's going to have finite vacuum expectation values, finite propagators, finite value for the renormalized mass. So this is going to be the theory that we want to use to do our calculations. If, for example, we're interested in figuring out what's happening at some collider somewhere. All right. So the assumption underlying this diagram is that you have a fixed point. Right? So obviously that's not generally going to be the case. So I want to flag that I'm, for the purpose of my remarks here, focusing on, apologies for using the PowerPoint, focusing on cases in which you do have a fixed point. All right. Okay. So the diagram implements step two. What I want to focus on is how we should think about these limits in the diagram, how we should think about the limiting process, and moreover, how we should think about the limits in the quantum field theory case and in the statistical mechanical case. So in the quantum field theory case, and both of these cases are sort of superimposed on the same diagram, in the quantum field theory case, what you're interested in is, as an infinite limit, is the limit in which you're taking the momentum to infinity. In the statistical mechanical case, what you're interested in is the limit in which you're reaching the critical point. Right? So that's a limit in which if the system has a critical temperature and you're reaching the critical point by approaching the critical temperature, then you're changing the critical temperature of the system, the temperature of the system and approaching the critical temperature. Still thinking about the same limits, but looking at them from a slightly different point of view. And in a rough kind of way, what we're doing here is flipping from looking at the analogical picture, where you're focusing on the mappings and going back and forth between the statistical mechanics and the quantum field theory. Now we're taking another point of view in which we're thinking about this rather as the application of the same piece of mathematics in both cases. So this is a quote which I think gives a nice concise explanation of what's going on from this other perspective, from Glib and Jaffe's book on quantum field theory from a functional integral point of view. And what they say is that they're focusing on the same construction, on the same sort of construction, right? In constructing interacting fields from lattice fields. Instead of talking about the momentum going to infinity, they're talking about the lattice spacing going to zero. So the interacting fields are constructed from lattice fields with lattice spacing A in the limit A goes to zero. There's a trivial rescaling which multiplies all lengths, lattice spacing correlation length by S. This rescaling is a unitary transformation and maps theories with lengths into distinct but equivalent theories. Okay, so this is the point that I was just making about physically equivalent theories and the renormalization group transformation. Taking advantage of this point of view, we see that it's immaterial whether we consider one of the following two limits. Okay, so if we're interested in quantum field theory, the limit that for physical purposes we're interested in is the continuum limit, right? Because we're trying to get rid of the artificial lattice that we imposed. So we take the lattice spacing A to zero. And we're interested in the case in which correlation length in quantum field theory, which is the inverse of the renormalized mass, remains constant. in contrast, in the statistical mechanical case, physically what we're interested in is, we're interested in the case in which we keep the lattice for the statistical mechanical system, right? Because we're thinking that the lattice is corresponding to atomic distances or some sort of fundamental physical quantity in the statistical mechanical case. And then what we're interested in the statistical mechanical case is the situation in which the correlation length goes to infinity, right? Situation in which you you have critical phenomena. So the point that Klim and Jaffe are making here is, from a mathematical point of view, because we can apply this unitary transformation to get from one of these limit situations to the other limit situation, they're mathematically equivalent, right? So this is why you can go from one to the other, mathematically speaking. Of course, from a physical point of view, the physical interpretation that you give in the two cases is different. This is the point I want to stress. I have a little bit more to say here. So we have our two limits. The latter of these equivalent points of view defines the critical point of a lattice theory. The trivial rescaling, which maps it onto the former, defines a scaling limit of the critical point. Thus, we see that a field theory can be constructed as a scaling limit of a lattice field theory, and this construction is equivalent to the conventional construction of taking the lattice space into zero. Okay, so as part of the context here, Glim and Jaffe are interested in a more rigorous construction in which you get more than finite-valued vacuum expectation values or finite propagators. They're interested in a more rigorous construction in which you also have a model which satisfies some set of axioms for quantum field theory. So they're interested in a more rigorous construction, but for our purposes, there's a more general point that they're making here, right? That we've been focusing on in the quantum field theory case, how it is you obtain the continuum field theory, and they're pointing out that if you're interested in attaining a continuum quantum field theory, there's two mathematically equivalent ways in which you could go about mathematically obtaining this theory. You could do it in the way we've always been thinking about it, right? In which you, in the quantum field theory, do the first thing, right? You impose a lattice, and then you and then you take the lattice to zero. Or you could do the new thing that Wilson introduces and collaborators introduce. You could take, instead of taking the lattice spacing to zero, you could keep the lattice spacing constant, go to the critical point, and then perform the scaling limit to get the quantum field theory that you want. So what they're pointing out here is that mathematically these are equivalent. So mathematically it turns out the second way, as in fact turns out to be the case, is it is easier than the first way, then go for it. Okay. So, as I said, I've focused here on a particular historical development in a much larger set of historical developments in which the developments in statistical mechanics fuel developments in quantum field theory, and developments in quantum field theory then are applied back into statistical mechanics. So another part of this story, which I'm not going to get a chance to get into today, is, of course, if we're more interested in statistical mechanics, then the same sort of trick turns out to be really useful in statistical mechanics as well, right? It turns out to be really useful if you're considering critical phenomena in statistical mechanics to use a continuum field representation, if you're interested in the critical exponents, if you're interested in universality. It turns out to be really useful to switch to the quantum field theory point of view, where you have a continuum theory and the finite correlation length. All right, so the inspiration goes both ways. Okay, so here's the point I want to first make, and then I'm going to question this in a couple, we'll provide a couple of ways of questioning this in a few minutes, which I want to get some feedback on. Okay, so Gloom and Joffe say, after they present the story that I just gave you, we see that there's an underlying identity of mathematical structure in these two problems, problems of quantum fields and the critical point, which are in very distinct parts of physics. Okay, so I think both parts of what they say are important here. Identity of mathematical structure is important, obviously, but also that we have to bear in mind that behind the identity of mathematical structure, we have very distinct parts of physics. So this is where the Maxwell story flows back in, right? So in the Maxwell case, you have identity of mathematical structure, and Maxwell can move back and forth between the different models because the mathematical structure is identical. But of course, we don't think that the physical structure that you get, the physical interpretation you give of the incompressible fluid model carries over to the electromagnetism case in virtue of the fact that there are robust physical similarities between incompressible fluids and the medium in which you have electromagnetic, or no medium in which you have electromagnetism. Right, so, so I want to point out that there are actually many, many physical differences underlying the analogies we've drawn between the statistical mechanical case and the quantum field theory case. Here are a couple of important ones for the quote I want to examine in a minute. Okay, so as I've been stressing, the goal of the Wilson code construction is to remove the artificially imposed lattice. So at the beginning of the day, and this is maybe where, well, I'll talk about this when I get to the next quote, but at least in 1974, when Wilson and Kogut are putting this forward as a method for doing quantum field theory, the goal of the construction is to get rid of the lattice, right? The lattice was put in to get rid of the infinities. You want to get rid of the lattice while avoiding the infinities still. Okay, so this means that clearly, when you think about the limit that you take in the quantum field theory case, that taking the momentum to infinity, that doesn't represent any sort of physical operation. Right. So what I mean by that is that if we go back to this diagram over here, if you focus on what's happening here, when we take the momentum goes to infinity limit, we have a series. We can either label the different theories in the space of theories we get by the momentum or value or by cutoff value or by the bare mass value. Either way, we don't think that what we have here is a sequence of different labels for different states of a single physical system, right? Contrast this to what we have in the statistical mechanical case. In the statistical mechanical case, when we take an analog limit, when we take the limit to correlation length goes to infinity, when we approach the critical point, we do think that different values of the correlation length are labeling different states of a single physical system. We do think that in order to change the correlation length, if, say, we're changing the temperature and bring the temperature closer to the critical temperature, we do think that different values of temperature are labeling different states of the same physical system. Okay, so this is a really key difference between the way these two limits are interpreted in the two cases. Something else I have here, which is part of what I didn't get to, was that an important goal of taking the infinite limit of the correlation length in the critical phenomena case is to obtain a theory that we think we need because we have all sorts of experimental results about different systems, a range of different physical systems at their critical points. In particular, I'm thinking here of the critical exponents, but you have other experimental data as well. This is a point that Leo Kadnoff, in particular, stresses in his story about how the history of the field went. That there was sort of an empirical demand for theories which could adequately deal with critical phenomena. Okay, so that from an experimental point of view, an empirical point of view, puts the statistical mechanical case in a different category than the quantum field theory case as well. Okay, so the point I want to make is I think it's important to simultaneously keep in mind that we do have similar mathematical structures here, identical mathematical structures in some cases, and so that we can apply the same mathematical structure in different cases, but that underlying the mathematical similarities, you have important physical differences. So we have to be careful about how we interpret what we're doing. Okay, so I think this is a sort of a cautionary example. I don't want to really, I think that there's a problem with this quote that I put up here. And I want to flag what I think the problem is not, right? So what I'm trying to do is trace reasons we'd have for thinking that this sort of conclusion is true. I think that, this is a quote from Peskin and Schroeder, a popular textbook on introductory quantum field theory, which focuses on this Wilson's approach to renormalization group methods. Okay, so the point that's being made here is that they say Wilson's analysis takes just the opposite point of view, that any quantum field theory is defined fundamentally with a cutoff momentum that has some physical significance. In statistical mechanical applications, this momentum scale is the inverse atomic spacing. In QED and other quantum field theories appropriate to elementary particle physics, the cutoff would have to be associated with some fundamental graininess of space-time, perhaps the result of quantum fluctuations in gravity. Okay, so what I want to point out here is that I have no problem with whether the conclusion is true or not. Okay, so as you can imagine, what follows this quotation is a description of the effective field theory program. So then the point that they go on to make is a point about how there are lots of different theories that could be compatible with what we observe at relatively low energy scales, including theories of this type, right, where there is a breakdown of quantum field theory and you get a non-quantum field theory at some point at much higher energy scales, which now are not experimentally accessible to us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this could be compatible with what we observe and our quantum field theories at relatively low energy scales. So I don't have a problem with what they go on to say, and indeed, I don't have a problem. It could, in fact, be true that there are that there is some fundamental cutoff. The problem I have with this quotation is the reason that's given for thinking there is one. Right. So one point I've been trying to make is that we have to be very careful to keep the interpretation of what's going on in the statistical mechanical case separate from the interpretation of what's going on in the quantum field theory case. So while it's true that in the statistical mechanical applications, we do have a physical cutoff, or we do think of the inverse atomic spacing as giving us a physical cutoff, we can't infer from that we can give the same interpretation to the same mathematical formalism that we're using in the quantum field theory case. Okay? In fact, this is what I've been stressing, right, and all along, that I've been talking about Wilson's point of view, and I've been stressing that part of the point is that when you flip to quantum field theory, what you're trying to do is get rid of the momentum cutoff. Right? You're trying to get rid of the lattice spacing. So there are lots of reasons for which this project might not work out, but this is at least what you're trying to do, right? So I think part of what's going on here in this quote is the identical mathematical formalism is, there's an assumption being made that you can apply the same type of physical interpretation to the limits in the two cases and the formalism you're getting in the two cases. That might also come from the sort of constructions where you sort of superimpose the statistical mechanical interpretation on top of the quantum field theory interpretation, which is the first kind of version of the limits I gave you, where you have the one diagram I was showing you, where you have statistical mechanics and quantum field theory on the same diagram, right? So that leads to think, and you can go back and forth, but you have to be very careful when you're going back and forth, when you're making those analogical mappings, to keep the physical interpretations of what you're doing separate. All right, so again, the conclusion may indeed be true, but my worry is about the reasons that are being used to support that conclusion. Okay, so now I get to my questions. So it seems to me that the moral that I've been trying to put in historical context, which I think when we look back at Maxwell seems kind of obvious, right? And I think that we can find the same kind of moral in the statistical mechanics and quantum field theory cases, namely, same piece of mathematics does not mean you have the same the same physics in both cases does not mean you have robust physical similarities between the two cases. I think that the way, if you look at the way that quantum field theory and statistical mechanics and condensed matter physics and all that is being done right now, it seems like it's being done in a way in which that moral is not being respected, right? So I just gave you a particular example of where you perhaps get into trouble by not following the moral. But I'm wondering if I'm missing something here, right? I'm wondering if there are reasons for identifying the physical theories of quantum field theory for particle physics and statistical mechanics. Okay, so what I've been urging is identify the mathematics. Sure, you have the same mathematical structure, but when you're talking about physical theories, be sure to keep them distinct because you're giving much different physical interpretations to the same piece of mathematics. But maybe, so I'm kind of wondering if there are reasons in the literature to doubt my moral that I've drawn. Okay, so here is what Iskson and Droop say in their book on statistical field theory, which is a book which goes between the particle physics and statistical mechanics traditions. They say, we often switch from one to the other interpretation, i.e. from the particle physics to the statistical mechanics interpretation, assuming that it will not be disturbing once it is realized that the exponential of the action in quantum field theory plays the role of the Boltzmann-Gibbs statistical weight in statistical mechanics. Okay, actually, that's part of the story I've left out. But the thought here is that they're recognizing in the preface that they're switching back and forth between the two interpretations of the same formalism they're introducing. And they think that once you realize that there's this further mapping that you can make, there's this further analogy you can draw between the two systems, you're not going to be confused. Okay. So I think that's not yet suggesting to identify the physical theories, right? They're recognizing that indeed there is a difference, the physical difference, but they think that there's no harm done if you switch between different interpretations back and forth. Here is another quote, which depending on how you interpret it, gets closer to the suggestion that there are good reasons for identifying the physical theories. Okay, then again, another quote from Preskind and Schroeder. A major theme of part two of this book will be that these two ideas, cutoff independence in quantum field theory and universality in the theory of critical phenomena, are naturally the same idea, and that understanding either of these ideas gives insight into the other. Okay, so there's one reading of this quote on which clearly it's true, right? Clearly, in virtue of the fact you have the same mathematical formalism here, the two limits they're talking about are the limits we've been talking about, right? So clearly, in virtue of the fact you have the same mathematical formalism, if you understand how one works, then you're going to have some insight into how the other works, right? As Maxwell, understanding how he could formulate his models with incompressible fluids could then have some understanding of how electromagnetism works. Okay, so if you interpret naturally the same idea, in that sense that understanding mathematical structure gives you some insight into what's going on, then I think that's great, that's true. If you interpret naturally the same idea as naturally the same physical idea, then I think that can't be quite right. All right, but I'm getting towards another quote here. So here is somebody who actually does suggest that we should identify the physical theories that we get from in quantum field theories and statistical mechanics. So this is a quote from Leo Padnov in one of his recent historical papers that he's written. So from the point of view of somebody who's more interested in statistical mechanics, right, where I've been taking the quantum field theory particle physics point of view, he says that the way he sees the history is statistical mechanics has maintained its structure since its invention. It has absorbed quantum mechanics and field theory while retaining its form as a summation over exponentials defined by the Hamiltonian. Okay, so again, of course, this is a part we didn't get into. Other ways in which you can map between quantities in quantum field theory and statistical mechanics. But the clear suggestion here is that in virtue of sharing the same mathematical form, we should think of statistical mechanics as being a theory which encompasses quantum mechanics and quantum field theory now in its scope. Okay. So my first question is what do we think about that? Right? Are there good reasons for doing that? Maybe I'll pause and see. I have a second question, but maybe I'll pause and see if people have reaction to that quote. Yeah. Right. Okay, so I think that kind of leads to my second question that I want to ask. Anybody at Western have a thought? No? Okay.
We temporarily lost the audio. We didn't really hear that.
Okay. Yeah.
We lost the audio for a bit, so we didn't actually hear that question and back and forth.
Okay. All right, so I said I thought the suggestion led to my second question, so I'll give you my second question. So it seems to me that if you're really going to take seriously what I've said, right, that this is a case in which you have the same mathematical formalism being applied in two cases, then this has practical implications for pedagogy, right? So if I'm right, then it seems like how should you go about the question about how you should go about teaching physics students. Now we're talking grad students, I assume, right, who are up to the stage where they're either going to be learning about, or perhaps both learning about critical phenomena and learning about quantum field theory, particle physics. How do you go about teaching them renormalization group methods, right, which get applied in both cases? So if you follow my thought seems to be, well, what you have here is a case in which you have the application of the same piece of mathematics in different domains. So teach them the same way you would teach them calculus, right? So give them an applied math course that teaches renormalization group methods abstractly, and of course you deal with the applications as well, right? But that's the way you go about doing it. So I love this quote, so I'm going to put it up again, and this is again from Wilson, again from 1975. So it seems like in 1975, he's thinking that the field should go this way too, right? Could be stuff has happened in between now and then that makes this not a live suggestion anymore, but let's see what he's suggesting in 1975. One of the most basic themes in theoretical physics is the idea that nature is described locally. The basic equations of all physics are local. For example, Maxwell's equations specify the behavior of electric and magnetic fields in an infinitesimal neighborhood of a point x. In order to be able to specify local equations, it's necessary to define continuum limits, namely the limits which define derivatives. The idea of the derivative and the idea of a continuum limit that underlies the derivative is therefore of great importance in all of physics. It is now becoming clear that there's a second form of continuum limit called the statistical continuum limit, which also has a very wide range of applicability throughout physics. So statistical continuum limit you're going to study using renormalization group methods. In the statistical continuum limit, functions of a continuous variable are themselves independent variables. For example, electric and magnetic fields throughout space can be independent variables in the statistical continuum limit. This happens in statistical or quantum mechanical problems where there are field fluctuations, so that one has to compute averages over an ensemble of fields. In statistical calculations, one does not compute the field at a point x. Instead, one computes correlation functions, that is, expectation values of products of fields, such as blah. In quantum mechanical problems, the correlation functions are sometimes replaced by vacuum expectation values of products of fields, or the propagators we saw, right? Okay, so the thought here is that we should regard renormalization group methods as being like calculus, right? As being like differential integral equations, which are a powerful mathematical method for a whole wide range of cases, right? Cases in which you have any physical theory at all, where you are using fields and where you have fluctuations in the fields, and where what you want to compute is this kind of thing, right? The kind of thing that is a correlation function, the kind of thing that is a vacuum expectation value. Something that doesn't get mentioned there is you can't have a dominant scale either, right? So, or at least the methods are most useful when you don't have a dominant scale. Okay, so it seems like in 1975, Wilson's going in the same direction that I'm kind of suggesting. So I take it, and I stand ready to be corrected on this point, but it seems to me that just looking at a few textbooks, it is not the case that graduate students in physics take an applied mathematics course in renormalization group methods. It seems more looking at the textbooks like you have the sort of thing that Peskin and Schroeder do, right? So Peskin and if you're interested in quantum field theory, in particle physics, they give you a little bit of a background on critical phenomena so you can understand enough to go back and forth between the statistical mechanics and the quantum field theory and the particle physics. Or you have one of the books on condensed matter physics is Spalik, and here's one of the examples I flagged earlier about how the term quantum field theory gets confusing because sometimes it gets applied to condensed matter physics, sometimes it's used reserved for particle physics like I've been using it. Okay, so similarly, you have this book, Quantum Field Theory in Condensed Matter Physics. So what you get introduced are renormalization group methods, which you can then use and apply in condensed matter physics. But how that's presented is, here's the bit of particle physics you should know, or here's a bit of quantum field theory you should know in order to understand how you can go back and forth between the two representations. Morgan, this might be what you were suggesting, right? So here's another quote from Peskin and Schroeder. They say at some point, in essence, the correspondence between quantum field theory and statistical mechanics adds to our reserves of knowledge a completely new source of intuition about how field theory expectation values should behave. Okay, so the thought here might be, right, this is sort of similar to what Maxwell said, right? He said, I like thinking about fluids. I don't like thinking about the electromagnetic field. I have no idea what that is, right? So I like thinking about fluids. I know what they are. And the way I think about fluids is, it's an imaginary collection of properties which may be employed for establishing certain theorems in pure mathematics in a way more intelligible to many minds and more applicable to physical problems than that in which algebraic symbols alone are used. Okay, so he says, I don't find it helpful to think about math. I find it helpful to think about these models in which I have fluids. So I guess a thought might be that I've been taking the view on the Maxwell case study from sort of contemporary standpoint. Right now, with the benefit of hindsight, we know what Maxwell was doing, right? And we can understand what he was doing. But perhaps in particle physics, we're not really there yet. Perhaps in particle physics, we're still at a point where I gave you a sketchy explanation of what the propagator is, right? Sort of think of it as particles at different lattice points and scattering. You can think of it in terms of scattering, but it seems much more intuitive to think about your icing model, right? You have an icing model. You can implement all sorts of other models. You have physical systems. You can do experiments on them. It seems much more intuitive to think in that way. So I think the thought here is that it's not just useful to think of what's going on in particle physics and quantum field theory in an abstract mathematical way. It's in addition useful to be able to go back and forth between the two theories because you have a much better handle on what's going on in the statistical mechanics examples or condensed matter examples. Right? Yeah.
It's hard to hear the question.
Mm-hmm. Oh, can you not hear the question?
No,
you can't hear the questions.
No, I mean, should I scream or what? No, I just said that you know, first that I agree with the point that it's important to keep the physics and the math questions apart, and just having the same math is not necessarily for that, but that was just quick before I go to question two. I think on question two, here, I agree in theory, but I think that the reason why students are not taught that as just one abstract kind of mathematics that can be applied in two ways is that it's not part of a clean, neat mathematical theory independent of those two specific physics examples. So it's not like, oh, you learn partial differential equations or something like, which is more kind of used in all over, something like that. It's still too much connected to two different things. But if you could find, if it can kind of evolve into a clean mathematical scheme where we can, and with even more applications, then it would be natural to do it like that. But I still think that it's too close. You just have these two.
Yeah, so I think that's an excellent point. That, so I was stressing the historical development of the particle physics, right? But on the mathematical side too, and that's just another point that Wilson makes back in 1975, which is still valid today, that you don't have a generic formulation of how you get your statistical continuum limit, right? It's more the sort of thing that when you look at a case, then you try and figure out how you can set it up that way. And in fact, the paper that I was quoting from was a paper about the Kondo problem, the problem where what he did essentially was figure out how you could set it up in that way in order to use the renormalization group technology, right, in order to solve the problem. But it's, you know, so there's still a lot of, there's a certain art to figuring out how to set the problem in the right way, right? Another point that I think is well taken is what I've been stressing today is similarities between the pieces of mathematics that you use. But there are a lot of differences between the way in which you apply renormalization group methods in statistical mechanics and the way in which you apply them in quantum field theory. Which speaks to your point that it's not like at this point, at this stage in the day in the mathematical development, you have a single theory which, people have been trying to figure out what the connections are for a while now, right? So it's not like nobody's trying, but we haven't yet reached the point in the mathematical development of the mathematical formalism where you can look at what's going on is there's one very, very general abstract piece of mathematics and you can apply it in different ways in different cases. So I think that point's really well taken too. I think what makes what leads to differences between the ways in which you find renormalization group methods applied in the two cases is that in the statistical mechanics case, at least to the sort of introductory textbook level where I am, what you're really interested in is the critical exponents, right? And that means that you're interested in different features of the calculations than you are in the quantum field theory particle physics cases. So then that leads to differences in the way you set things up and the way the sorts of problems you want to solve using the framework too, right?
Ask you about your first question. So are there good reasons to identify physical theories? It seems like there's parts of your talk that might be part of a good argument that absolutely should not identify these physical theories. And that has to do with the kind of QFT that you've constructed. Lim and Jaff mentioned this, right? It doesn't satisfy the axioms, the normal axioms like this. We're talking about Lorentz invariance or gauge invariance. So you're not constructing, you know, QED or something. You're constructing a scalar phi force. So there might be a good reason for not identifying it because the construction of an actual physical QFT that's, you know, consistent with the standard model requires these other constraints. Because other physical information.
So the point is that I very clearly simplified, right? So when at the beginning of the day, I simplified in various ways and restricted to the special case in particular in which you have a fixed point, right? It does the job you want it to do. So that's going to be one problem. And then they're going to be, in the Glim and Jaffe project, there are going to be a number of other problems. I guess I should say, and this, I guess, is what relates this project to other work I've done, right? That that taking the bigger view that you get when you're thinking about the project not in the sort of textbook way where the aim at the end of the day is just to have a finite set of propagators or vacuum expectation values, but where you're being more ambitious and you're also wanting to have a representation that satisfies whatever demands your axioms make of it, right? So if you once you step out to that larger picture on what's going on, then you see the relationship between statistical mechanics and quantum field theory as being one thing you can exploit to try and do that, right? So what Glim and Jaffe do in their book is they, and this is in the 80s now, right? So is they say, that was an awesome idea. Let's pick that up and let's try and make that rigorous. And instead of just getting the finite vacuum expectation values, let's try and use that to construct models for particular interactions. And you're right, they don't get to the stage of getting QED, right? Or they don't get to the stage of getting something that's a rigorous quantum field theory with realistic interactions in it. But I think if you take the wider view, you see that as, okay, that's one strategy for finding the continuum thing we're looking for, right? So then more recent work picks up on different strategies. So in I'm talking about more recent work in the axiomatic model construction tradition.
Oh. Yeah? So just to clarify, so having a finite set of vacuum expectation values is not equivalent to having a full Lagrangian. You haven't constructed the whole QFT.
Well, if what you're interested in. Yeah, so it is what you're looking for if you're interested in predicting what's going to happen at the Large Hadron Collider, say, right? But if you're interested in Glim and Jaffe's project, then what you also want is pick your set of axioms, right? It's going to say more, it's going to. Yeah, that's the point I was making. Does Western have questions?
Actually, I do, yeah. So there seemed to be when you're looking at the QFT systems mechanics literature, there seemed to be a shift in what people, were saying, quotations from the 70s and the quotations from the textbooks in the 90s and beyond, in that, you know, Wilson and Kogut and Wilson back in the 70s were emphasizing, even though you're using, you have this mapping between mathematical methods, the idea was the physical theories are very different, and in particular the assumption was in the quantum field theory case, is the real, real theory you're looking at, that you want, is the continuum limit, because we think that, you know, that really what we have is a quantum field theory, which is defined at our very small scales. And then later on, it seems the suggestion is, well, actually, no, there's a deeper physical similarity, and we should take the lesson to be that there is some kind of physical cutoff, some kind of physical momentum. And I wonder if part of the shift, reason for the shift, lies in, as people are working, they get more and more skeptical about whether for our actual quantum field theories, the continuum limit actually exists, and we should actually take that as a serious candidate for a physical theory, or whether we should actually take seriously the idea that there is a physical cutoff, you know, beyond which the theory, you know, stops making sense.
So, I'm not sure where I'm looking here. But okay, I think I'll look at you and maybe that works. Anyway, I think that's part of the story, part of what's going on here, right? But what I'd like to, I don't think that there's ever really a point at which, certainly there in the Wilson and Kogut stuff, there's the hope, right? And the thought is that the reason for constructing quantum field theory in this way is because you want to get the continuum theory, right? So the later development that you get later in the 70s and the 80s is thinking about quantum field theory in more the effective field theory kind of way, right? Where you're not just taking a particular quantum field theory with a particular Lagrangian and then trying to find the continuum limit of it. You figure, okay, well, if really what I focus on is the effective theory that's valid at the energy scales that are accessible, then I realize that there's all sorts of Lagrangians that could be compatible with this with the experimental results I have. Indeed, you could have something that's not even a quantum field theory, which is going to be the right theory at much higher energies, right? So I think that there definitely is that shift later on. But even in the Wilson and Kogut material, I think that still there what you have is the going back and forth between the two ways of thinking about quantum field theory in that case, right? So because you have the identity, which lets you transform from the correlation functions to the vacuum expectation values, you can sort of go back and forth and think about things either in the correlation length kind of statistical mechanical way, or you can think about it in terms of the taking the momentum cutoff to infinity kind of way. So I think even in that early work, there's the shifting back and forth, which I think leads to not as careful separation of the contrasting physical interpretations of the two theories as I'd like. Another point to make, and I think that this comes back to the quote I had from Peskin and Schroeder about the about giving a physical interpretation to the cutoff in the quantum field theory case, is that we should be careful about identifying our reasons for thinking that there's some physical cutoff, right? So a possible reason could be we think there must be some physical cutoff because there's no fixed point for a particular theory, right? But that is something which comes out of the construction, the failure of the construction, right? But it's sort of an additional consideration from what I was talking about, or it's what happens when you try and do the taking the cutoff thing, right? Taking the cutoff to infinity thing and then failing, right? Also, I think we need to keep, and this is something I've been talking about for a long time, but I think we need to keep the reasons that we're getting from other theories, right, from quantum gravity or what other theories, separate as reasons for thinking that there's a different theory at high energy scales from the reasons that we're getting from particle physics intrinsically, right? So I still think that even when you do adopt the later point of view, it's careful. It's important to take on board. I think that the morals that I was trying to draw are still compatible with the later point of view, right? Or at least I hope they are.
Good, thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Just let me give you the microphone.
Yeah, just generally one thing that I find interesting is to discuss the idea of kind of semantics in scientific theories at all and how they are supposed to be given some kind of meaning or what that is, because it's especially when there is just one very complex mathematical framework supposed to apply to something very different, weird. And the idea with the analogical thinking, just going back even to the quote by Maxwell in the beginning, is more or less to just use these kind of analogies and not take them too seriously. And it's basically using in the kind of realist and realist, it's a very kind of anti-realist attitudes to the models described, so to say. And I think that I'm not kind of full-on anti-realist at all, but it's almost like in physics, in these examples, and also in considerations in dualities and string theory, which I've thought a lot about, which is the situation is almost the inverse. It's supposed to be the same physics, but the mathematics and the pictures is, at least at first sight, very different. Right? So the whole issue here is generally something that I think needs to be brought up more, that what we have is an abstract thing. We have only analogies to things we know more familiarly to kind of get a grasp on it. And maybe if we, just one example, when you have that and connecting to what Morgan said, that when there are mappings and you just feel more familiar with one of them, just play around with it here and think that, oh, we can assume that there would be something else here, or we can think about this other thing in this way, but always with a kind of having in mind a pinch of salt what we really mean here. We don't really clearly know what we mean. It's just as much, not only just deciding what is right or wrong, it's also kind of forming new concepts by doing this. Kind of, it's, yeah.
Yeah, so actually, I'm just at the beginning of thinking about the Maxwell stuff, but I'm teaching a seminar in the fall on 19th philosophical, well, I'm not in a history department, so it's called Philosophical Issues Raised by 19th Century Physics, right? So what I'm going to be doing in that seminar is tracing some of this stuff in more detail from Calvin and through to Maxwell, mostly, and then thinking about atoms and that kind of thing. But I think that there's a couple of interesting things about what are going on in the Maxwell case. First of all, I think it's significant that the education that Maxwell and Calvin and other natural philosophers of the time got, right? So it was they went through Cambridge, they went through the Tripos, so they had the mathematical background mixed with the physics, but they also had Maxwell did anyway some grounding in philosophy. Right? That was part of his very early education up in Scotland, in Edinburgh. Right, so I think that that was something that made him self-conscious. I think it's relevant that this is the sort of first time when you have this kind of thing happening, where people are not just having some particular physical application in mind, like say Newton with the calculus, right, and then developing the mathematical resources that you need in order to deal with that case, but saying, hey, look, we have this mathematical theory. We can pick it up and learn and apply it in different cases, right? So I think that maybe they were more self-conscious about it than we are today, because now we're familiar with that kind of thing, right? So I think there's a strange kind of way in which that was new to some extent to Maxwell and his predecessors and his rough contemporaries, right? That kind of methodology in physics. And so that made him more self-conscious about what he was doing, and that made him, you say, more of an anti-realist, but it maybe made him more, I would say, self-conscious about what he was doing and why, and the extent to which he should take the physical interpretation seriously versus use it as a sort of intuitive technique, as he points out. So there's a strange way in which I think that a little bit of that has been lost, at least from the literature I've read, mostly the textbook literature in the statistical mechanics and quantum field theory tradition now, right? That there's, especially what I've looked at closely is the Peskin and Schroeder book, and there's a lot of places in which you say, okay, great, particle physics makes predictions about what happens in statistical mechanics, and you know, going back and forth using very strong language like that, which is actually, and I don't want to point them out. I don't want to criticize them, because for pedagogical purposes, that's probably really useful, right? So I think that needs to be borne in mind, that it's a textbook, right? For pedagogical purposes, that's really useful. But taking a step back, I think that kind of thing is kind of puzzling or confusing, and that we need to be a bit more careful and self-conscious, like Maxwell was, about what we're doing in these kinds of cases. Yeah. So anyway, I think this is sort of my next kind of future research, is to look more carefully at the history. Which, have you been doing that at Western? Reading Maxwell? Yeah. I can't hear you.
Okay.
I can't hear you.
In fact, we've been reading through Maxwell's On Faraday's Lines of Force, so one of those quotes that you put up was familiar to us.
Excellent. So what do you think about what I just said then, my very initial take on Maxwell and Calvin? And
I think you're absolutely right that because this, you know, what he was doing was relatively new, he was a lot more self-conscious about it than you know, people would be today. I think it's interesting because he's spending more time explicitly explaining what he's doing and why than what you would find in and this wasn't even the textbook. This was a research paper for the read to the Cambridge Royal Society, the Royal Society. So
right.
It was aimed at an audience of physicists, and he's being much more explicit about what he thinks he's doing than anyone would be in a paper published in Physical Review these days.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And much more careful.
I'm not sure about that, but that's unfair,
okay, all right, I'll...
All right, do you have any other thoughts at Western, or should we wrap up here?
I think we're up. Any other...
I'm good.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much for
thanks, Marie.
Thank you. I'm sure I will see you soon. People at
Westwood. Okay, yep.
And thank you, people here.